The death toll from a suicide bombing at a crowded mosque in Pakistan's Peshawar has risen to 47. One more Palestinian man is killed by the Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Tehran summons Ukraine chargé d'affaires to protest the senior Ukraine official's remarks about a drone attack in the Iranian city of Isfahan. World News with me, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. The death toll from a suicide bombing at a crowded mosque in the northwestern Pakistani city of Peshawar has risen to 47. According to government officials, some 150 people also got wounded in that explosion that ripped through the mosque close to the police headquarters. Many of the casualties are from among police officers who gathered there for noon prayers. An entire wall of the mosque and its roof were blown out, burying a number of policemen under the rubble. A militant group known as Tehrik-e-Taliban in Pakistan has claimed responsibility. Peshawar, that borders Afghanistan, is frequently targeted by that group. The Pakistani Taliban have stepped up attacks since ending a peace deal with Islamabad last year. Authorities have put security forces on high alert in the wake of the explosion. Our Islamabad correspondent Nasser Kazmi joined us a little while ago for some details on the Peshawar blast. Let's take a listen.
Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan has claimed the responsibility of the attack. We have seen that the government has been engaged with the talks with this outlawed group, Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, in recent years, and more than 17 accords were signed between Pakistani government and the TTP, but there were no fruitful results of those ceasefires. And 3 months ago, this outlawed group again ended the ceasefire and started carrying out attacks in all across Pakistan, especially in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, at the same time in southwestern Balochistan province. So at the moment, the government is trying to control the situation, but we have seen that Peshawar and its adjacent areas came under terrorist attacks in recent months. So the Prime Minister of Pakistan has appealed the nation to donate bloods for those who are in dire need of blood in the hospitals to save their lives at the moment.
Now, Palestinians have held a funeral for a young man killed by Israeli troops in the occupied West Bank. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 26-year-old Naif Salman Abu Foda was shot in the head at the entrance of Al-Khalil. The shooting came just days after regime forces launched a deadly raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank. The incursion left 10 people dead and dozens more injured. Israel has stepped up crackdown across the occupied territories. 35 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank so far this month. Our correspondent Amala Monakandil has some more details regarding the killing of the young Palestinian in Al-Khalil.
Circumstances of killing yet another Palestinian in Al-Khalil this time, it's not clear. What we know is that a 26-year-old Nassim Abu Foda arrived at the Israeli military checkpoint known as 160. It's south Al-Ibrahimi, Al-Haram Al-Ibrahimi, in the city of Al-Khalil. He arrived there and Israeli forces opened fire. They shot him directly in the head. He was transferred to hospital and immediately he died in the Palestinian hospital in Al-Khalil. The Israeli military didn't issue any statements yet to say, as usual, that a Palestinian tried to carry out an anti-Israeli operation or to stab Israeli soldiers or to shoot Israeli soldiers. As usual, many justifications and excuses. What we received is that a Palestinian man arrived at a military checkpoint and he was shot dead.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced a series of punitive measures against Palestinians in response to the Friday shooting in Al-Quds that led to the death of seven Israelis. It wounded several others. The measures include moves to expand settlements in the occupied territories. Our correspondent has more from Ramallah.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced a series of punitive steps against Palestinians in response to Friday's shooting in East Al-Quds. The operation, which was carried out by 21-year-old Khaira Alqam from East Al-Quds, killed seven Israeli settlers and wounded several others. The steps announced late on Saturday during a meeting of the Israeli cabinet included new moves to expand Jewish settlements. The cabinet, however, has not provided details on how settlements would be expanded. Other measures include granting gun permits to Israelis, a move seen as a green light to Israeli civilians' use of guns against Palestinians.
These are parts of more collective punishment, more aggression and crimes against Palestinians. They are speaking about home demolitions and stripping citizenship of the families of those who carry out such operations from the real owners of the land, and more such moves against the people of Al-Quds.
The cabinet also decided more punishments for the families of those who carry out shooting operations by deciding to demolish their homes. Early on Sunday, Israeli troops raided Attur neighborhood where martyr Khaira Alqam came from and sealed up the entrances of his family home in preparation for its demolition. The Israeli cabinet voted to revoke residency and citizenship rights of families of those who carry out shooting operations from Al-Quds and lands occupied in 1948.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much and will not break the Palestinian resistance. And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. And nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
Friday's operation came only one day after Israeli forces shot dead nine Palestinians during a raid on a refugee camp in the northern West Bank city of Jenin. That brings to more than 30 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the start of this year. Observers argue that the Israelis themselves should be now worried about the repercussions of the right-wing regime's policies, including the deadly raid on Jenin. They add that the Palestinians won't fear Netanyahu's further restrictions and collective punishment they already are used to under Tel Aviv's occupation. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Tehran slams this foolish and biased and anti-Iran analogy by the German chancellor, saying that it shows that Olaf Scholz is standing on the wrong side of history. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says there is, however, historical similarity between the extremism in Germany now and the failures of that country's leaders prior to the Second World War. Nasser Kanani says that the promotion of violence and hatred is the outcome of both cases. He said that some people are using human rights as a means of painting a positive picture of themselves. He then criticized the German silence on Israeli crimes and brutality. During a visit to Argentina on Sunday, Scholz drew a parallel between the dictatorship in the late 20th century and Iran's response to the recent riots in the country. Tehran has summoned Ukraine chargé d'affaires in reaction to Kiev's comments about a foiled drone attack in Iran. The move came after a senior Ukrainian presidential aide implied the role of his country in the incident and linked it to the war in Ukraine. Iran's defense ministry on Saturday successfully repelled a drone attack on a workshop in the central city of Isfahan. The attack did not cause any loss of life or disruption to the workshop's operations. The Russian defense ministry says that its troops have made more advances in the eastern Donbas region, inflicting losses on Ukrainian forces there.
In the South Donetsk and Zaporizhia directions, units of the Eastern Group of Forces continuing successful offensive operations took more advantageous positions and inflicted a defeat in the combat on units of the 1st Tank Brigade of the Armed Forces of Ukraine in the area of the settlement of Vugledar of the Donetsk People's Republic.
Russian installed officials in the region also confirmed earlier that Russian forces were advancing near Vugledar, a town in Donetsk region, which has been the epicenter of fighting in recent months. Russian officials made similar statements about ongoing battles for the town of Bakhmut, but they said it was too early to talk about besieging the town. Ukraine's president previously described the situation on the front lines as very tough. Volodymyr Zelensky said the people of Bakhmut, Vuhledar, and other areas in Donetsk are under constant Russian attacks. Donetsk, Kherson, Zaporizhia, and Luhansk voted overwhelmingly to secede from Ukraine and join the Russian Federation in the course of referendums in September last year. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has fired the chairman of the ruling Conservative Party after his advisor concluded that Nadeem Zahawi breached a ministerial code over tax affairs. The dismissal puts under the spotlight the fact how UK ministers over the years have put their interests above those of national interests.
While the British public is grappling with an unprecedented cost of living crisis, the dismissal of a high-ranking Tory official has added insult to the injury of millions of Britons. That after it emerged that chairman of the Conservative Party, Nadeem Zahawi, paid a penalty to HM Revenue and Customs over previously unpaid tax as part of a multi-million pound dispute while he was Chancellor. HM Revenue and Customs is a non-ministerial department of the UK government responsible for collecting taxes. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak was quick to react to save his party from yet another scandal. He fired Zahawi for what he called serious breaches of the ministerial code over his tax affairs. An investigation by Sunak's ethics advisor concluded that Zahawi had broken the rules by repeatedly failing to declare an HMRC probe into his tax affairs. The dispute concluded with a £5 million settlement, including a penalty. But on Sunday, Sunak sent a letter to Zahawi saying his ethic advisor had concluded there was, quote, a serious breach of the ministerial code. In the letter, Sunak also announced his removal from the post. The dismissal came as Sunak was under fire himself for initially standing by Zahawi before ordering an internal investigation. But the premier defended his stance, arguing that integrity in politics was the reason he did not sack the Tory chairman in time.
I think that's the right thing to do to ensure that we have integrity in politics, but to do that in a professional way, that's what we're doing.
But many Britons remain unsatisfied with Sunak's handling of the issue. They reason out that the Prime Minister, who acted within hours over his advisor's report, should have sacked Zahawi earlier.
Well, Nadeem Zahawi obviously should be thinking about his future, but I think the bigger question here is why the Prime Minister didn't act earlier, what he knew about this situation, and why he seems to be continuously putting the interests of his party above those of his country. He knew there were allegations about Zahawi for a long time. He then knew that Zahawi had been negotiating a deal with HMRC at the same time as he was in charge of HMRC as the Chancellor. So I think the biggest question today isn't actually for Zahawi, it's actually for the Prime Minister.
Sunak also faces scrutiny over whether he knew about the minister's tax affairs and when he was told there could be a reputational risk to the government after Zahawi's appointment in October. Now many, including former high-ranking officials, suggest that Sunak's premiership risks being brought down by scandals swirling around the Tories. One such is high-stakes parliamentary inquiry into whether Sunak's predecessor Boris Johnson misled lawmakers over Partygate.
Well, dismissal comes at a time when the UK is grappling with an unprecedented cost of living crisis. The record high inflation has prompted workers from different sectors to stage mass walkouts in recent weeks. They demand better working conditions and wages in line with inflation.
The sacking of Nadeem Zahawi comes as Sunak's government facing decades-high inflation and a wave of public sector strike while trailing badly in opinion polls ahead of an expected 2024 election. To many, the tax evasion of Zahawi has not come as a surprise. But for a prime minister who promised accountability, professionalism and integrity while taking office, this is just a disgrace. But what happens when governments, especially in so-called first world countries, are submerged in corruption? Many argue that politics in those countries are too chaotic to the point where things get out of hand, like what happened in the case of Zahawi. So the ironic situation is when a man briefly in charge of the treasury does not pay taxes himself while insisting that others must pay. Apart from that, the UK is already grappling with a cost of living crisis which has been unprecedented in a century. This, coupled with the skyrocketing inflation, have so far prompted hundreds of thousands of workers from various sectors, including railway, postal, dock, energy and medical, to stage walkouts over pay and working conditions. While workers' union accuse the government of inaction and call for talks to resolve the disputes, workers want their pay in line with the inflation that is currently at the level of nearly 11%. The UK is also facing rampant food and energy costs. Some even struggle to make ends meet or even afford to put food on the table.
There's people around here who can't afford to put clothes on their kids' backs or food on their table, and that he has mistakenly missed an error.
Charities are stocking up duvets, sleeping bags, hot water bottles, and blankets because they know that people can't afford to heat their homes anymore. That puts in the spotlight the number of governments which one after another took the helm at number 10 and attempted to resolve the cost of living crisis, but to no avail. The much bigger question is that how can the Sunak government run the country when it is unable to cope with this and other crises happening over there?
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
pardon me, Professor. I have a question.
Yes, please.
I have been studying on tourism topics for my presentation at the university. I prefer to talk about Iranian and Islamic monuments. For example, mosques.
That's great.
By the way, do you have a suggestion in this regard? A unique place, for example?
Then what about the Jame Mosque of Darab?
You mean the mosque with four minarets?
Yes, that's it.
Thank you. So I don't waste time to take a trip there. The Jame Mosque of Darab is a historical mosque which dates back to the Seljuqid era. This mosque is located in the city of Darab, Fars province, southern Iran. This historical mosque is unique regarding its architecture and the way the shabistans and minarets are built. The Jame Mosque of Darab is the only mosque in Iran which has four minarets. The main structure of the mosque is made of bricks, like other structures of the Seljuqid era. This mosque is registered in Iran's National Heritage List. I have to get off the bus. Here we are in Darab. I came a long way to get here, but it's worth it. One of the advantages of traveling by bus is that you can see different cities and villages on your way. Well, there are a few blocks to the mosque, and I prefer to take a walk to my destination. Okay, I was saying, one of the wonders of Iran is undoubtedly its unique Islamic architecture, which is especially seen in the mosques. I love the style of mosques architecture. What is interesting for me about the architecture of mosques is these structures' smart symmetry. Blue tiles, the design of minarets, domes, and Quranic calligraphy on the walls. Oh, unique! The arched vaults at the entrances of shabistans of the mosques make me feel good, giving me a positive energy. a mystic sense. I can't describe it properly. Into details, I should say that this mask, unlike other masks, has four minarets. And unlike other minarets, this mask's minarets are not circular. What attracts me more to it is the big area around the mask with palm and orange trees. Beautiful. This mosque is actually the oldest structure of the city of Darab, which dates back to late Seljuqid era. Although it went through major reconstruction during the Safavid rule. Ooh, it's a long time ago. Let's enter the mosque. I feel curious to know how it looks like. I have heard that inside the mosque has a rectangular shape which must be very spectacular. The mosque. What is interesting for me about it is the mihrab. It's simple, unique, and admirable. Oh, the light which has illuminated the interior area is the reflection of sunlight on the green glasses of the roof. Oh, the architecture of the structure is designed for warm and cold seasons of the year. Let me take some photos. And there is another attractive place which I have to visit. Let me get out of here. Yes, here we are in the outer area of the mosque again. Just at the feet of the minarets, there is a gate which leads to a staircase by which you can go up. Oh, the stairs are thin and the ceiling is short. So it's a little hard to go up. But it's possible anyway. Oh, here I am. There are two gates, which one of them is opened to the roof and the other one leads to the minarets. And I want to go on the roof. Okay, I am here on the roof. I can see the entire city. Oh, God. Look at those pretty palm and orange trees. I love them. Iranian architecture is perfect.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We've been talking about the heart, and we said that in the month of Rajab, inshallah, we're going to be looking at the study of qalb in Islam, the heart, and in particular how to revive it, right? And we started with this tradition from our fifth Imam Al-Baqir, alayhi afdalu salatu wassalam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad, where he says, Al-Qulubu thalatha. There are three types of hearts, he says. Qalbun mankus, a heart that is upside down, reversed. He says, لا يعصر على شيء من الخير. He says, no, nothing good is absorbed by this heart. Yeah? It is just upside down. It can't absorb anything. And then he says, وقلب فيه نقطة سوداء. A heart which has a dark spot in it. فالخير والشر فيه يعتلجان. He says that good, that truth and falsehood wage war in this heart. And whoever is successful in the end, that is how the heart will become, either mankus or the last way. And then the third one, he says, وَقَلْبٌ مَفْتُوحٌ, a heart which is open. Yeah? And in this heart, he says, فِيهِ مِصْبَاحٌ. He says, in this heart, there is a light. Yeah? Well, what type? An illuminated light. يَزْهَرُ. Yeah? فَلَا يُطْفَأَ نُورُهُ إِلَى يَوْمِ الْقِيَامَةِ. And the light of this heart will not extinguish until the day of judgment. وَفِيهِ وَهُوَ قَلْبُ الْمُؤْمِنِ. It is the heart of a believer, this heart. You know, and so our goal in our lives is to end up with a heart which is illuminated, the heart of a mu'min. And what a better way to understand what a heart of a believer looks like than to look at the heart of the King of Believers. Yeah? That to look at the heart of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And so today, inshallah, we're going to be looking at just different aspects of what it takes to be a believer's heart. Yeah, what are the components that are needed? What are the attractions that we have? And again, when we're looking at the heart of someone like our first Imam alayhi salam, whatever we're going to be talking about today is not an exhaustive list. It's impossible, you know. There are so many dimensions to the hearts of our first Imam alayhi salam, that we can look at the faith that he had in God. We can look at that being translated into his God consciousness, right? Being the Imam al-Muttaqin. We can look at his detachment from dunya, and we can go on and on. But I want to just look at some very practical things that you and I can apply in our lives. That if we work on these things, inshallah, maybe we can get some of that illumination from the light of our imam so that our hearts can become illuminated. The first area that I think is really important that when we look at the life of the imam alayhi salam is that the imam's heart took pride in working hard for his family. Yeah, now, I know that sounds simple, right? Alhamdulillah, you know, I think that all of us work hard for our families. This is why we leave the house early in the morning and we come back late at night. Sometimes we need both of our spouses to work. Sometimes if there's one spouse taking care of the house's needs, no one doesn't work hard, right? No one doesn't work hard. But what's amazing is that when you look at the heart of the imam and what he teaches us in particular, he teaches us that no one should, that the person themselves will be responsible and judged for how well they took care of their family's needs. Yeah, I think this is an important point, okay? Just stay with me on this. We all work hard. And in that working hard, we find that sometimes our ability to care for the nurturing of our family is not looked into as detailed as it should. Yeah, because if I'm out all day working, my kids are in school 8 hours a day, they come back, maybe they have external exercises or whatever it is, we sign them up for different things. Sometimes we may need a nanny to look after us. And none of these things are wrong, right? Because Allah has given us these abilities, Allah has given us these resources. What the Imam alayhi salam is basically trying to teach us, and I think this is a really valuable point, that no matter how busy we are with halal rizq, we're not even talking about something shady, just to live in this world in a halal way, the responsibility for how our children turn out will not fall on anyone else but the parents themselves. Yeah, this is what the Imam teaches us. You know, we have to understand this. You know, it said once the Imam alayhi salam went to the market in Kufa and he purchased a bag of dates. And فَحَمَلَهُ فِي طَرَفِ رِدَائِهِ, like he held it in the side of his abba. Maybe not to show off, maybe there were poor people. I think there's adab in all of these things that the imam obviously does, right? But he carried it, but the people saw that the imam alayhi salam was carrying something heavy, and so they rushed to him. And they said, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, nahnu nahmiluhu. We will carry this for you. Please allow us to carry this for you. And this is what he replies back. You know, he says, Rabbul Iyal ahakku bihamlihi. He says, the one who is the Rabb of the family, the one who is in charge of the family, has the most right and is needful to carry this themselves. Yeah? You can't pass the buck on to someone else, right? Today, we send our kids to school for education. We may send our kids to madrasa for Islamic education. We may bring them here. But the nurturing of the child requires constant effort, requires constant nourishment, requires constant looking after. And even though I may have others who are helping me, and I need to have others who are helping me because of the lifestyle, fine. But the others will not be held accountable or judged except for the person themselves. Yeah? And this is something that we learn from the imam. The importance of not only working hard for the physical provisions of the family, but the spiritual provision of the family is also going to be judged by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and how well we did. And there is no one more responsible for this than the heads of the family themselves. So that's the first lesson. And again, like I know it's very simple, but it's something that I think we forget sometimes. How many times, right, have we had this question as madrasa teachers that the mosque, the madrasa is not providing enough for my child. My child still doesn't know how to read Quran. They come to mosque. Mosque programs are boring. We've talked about this many times. Yeah, that man, this is an hour and a half, 2 hour program that comes about once a week. We've sat through worse and more boring things than this before. Yeah? But there is a certain ruhani here. There is a certain spirituality here. There's a certain nourishment that our souls are getting that we may not understand because our mind and bodies are only equipped with physical nourishment. But there is a spiritual nourishment that is taking place here that cannot be duplicated with anything else. And the one responsible to bring our children and our families to this are the heads of the family, right? And so we are going to be judged by this.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The reports that Poland allegedly gave Ukraine several MiG-29 fighter jets under the guise of spare parts. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov has responded to these planned deliveries as evidence that the West is becoming more directly involved in the conflict, despite European and American politicians claiming otherwise. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT wrote in this regard, in spring 2022, Warsaw secretly delivered several of its MiG-29 fighter jets to Ukraine, despite the Polish government officially denying any such deals, a local paper has claimed, citing sources. According to Dezhniy Gazeta Pravda DGP, the planes were sent over using a combined method, apparently meaning that they were delivered in a disassembled state and declared as spare parts. DGP wrote recently, citing sources within the Polish government, the fuselage and the wings are also spare parts. Back in March, in the first month of the Russia special operation in Ukraine, Washington rejected a plan of transfer of Polish MiG-29 jets to Ukraine, stating the move was too escalatory and risk directly involving the U.S.
or a NATO ally in the conflict, potentially triggering a direct confrontation with Russia. In April, however, the Pentagon stated that unnamed U.S. allies had helped bolster Ukraine's fleet of fighter jets by donating unspecified spare parts which were supposedly used to restore many of Kiev's damaged planes. The latest article by DGP now seems to suggest that that ally could have been Poland, which in late April was also revealed to have provided Ukraine with $7 billion worth of military aid, including half of its tanks, dozens of howitzers, Grad MRLS, and missiles for MiG-29 and Su-27 fighter jets, among other munitions. In recent weeks, the U.S. seems to have abandoned some of its prior concerns about supplying heavy weapons to Ukraine and now plans to deliver a number of its M1 Abrams tanks to Kiev, while Germany, Poland, and Finland intend to send dozens of their Leopard 2 tanks. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov has responded to these planned deliveries as evidence that the West is becoming more directly involved in the conflict, despite European and American politicians claiming otherwise. That's as Russia has repeatedly urged the West to stop pumping Ukraine with weaponry, arguing it would only prolong the conflict and lead to more bloodshed. Meanwhile, RT reported the U.S. arms maker claims it could supply fighter jets to countries that are willing to give them to Kiev. Any countries that are prepared to provide Kiev with F-16 fighter jets would face no shortage of supply. Top U.S. weapons manufacturer Lockheed Martin has suggested, stating that it is ready to meet any new demand. In an interview with the Financial Times recently, the weapons manufacturer's chief operating officer, Frank St. John, said there is a lot of conversation about third-party transfer of F-16s, meaning countries that wish to buy and then re-export their U.S. jets to Ukraine. Although Lockheed Martin is not directly involved in any talks regarding potential deliveries of military aircraft to Kiev, St. John stated his company nevertheless plans to ramp up production of the fighter planes to get to the point where it will be able to backfill pretty capable any countries that choose to do third-party transfers to help with the current conflict. His statements come after the U.S. and Germany announced this week that they would be sending their heavy tanks to Ukraine. The move has reignited discussion about other weapon transfers, as Kiev reiterated its demands for more missiles and military aircraft. Washington, however, has so far remained reluctant to provide any fighter jets to Ukraine, fearing these could be used to strike Russian territory, further escalating the 11-month-long conflict between the two countries in Eastern Europe. Furthermore, any sales or transfers to third countries of any American-made fighter jets must also be approved by the White House. A U.S. defense official has told the Financial Times that Washington remains in contact with its international allies and partners regarding the needs of Ukraine, but noted that there is nothing to announce regarding F-16s. The Netherlands, on the other hand, which has about 40 F-16 fighter jets, has recently said that it would consider any formal request to send the planes to Ukraine with an open mind and that it holds no taboos in relation to military support. Russia has repeatedly warned the West that continued deliveries of weapons to Ukraine only prolonged a conflict and risked a direct confrontation between NATO and Moscow. It also said its forces would treat foreign weapon systems in Ukraine as legitimate targets.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4th, 2023. As I mentioned previously, if you read the books about the wives of the martyrs, love and serenity can be clearly seen there. One can also see how this man, who has made his way to the middle of the battlefield, whether in the holy defense, in defeating the holy shrines, or in the other difficult fields, finds calm next to his wife. His mental turmoil abates, and love keeps him on his feet and gives him courage and strength so that he is able to carry on with his work. So, this is what a woman is like as a wife. She is a source of tranquility. She is a source of love, calm, and such things. Now, I have already mentioned this about tranquility, and made from it its mate, that he might find comfort with her. This is a verse from the Holy Quran. In another verse, it is stated, He created for you mates from your own selves, that you may take comfort in them. And he ordained affection and mercy between you. The Holy Quran, chapter 30, ayah 21. Affection means love. Mercy means kindness. Love and kindness are exchanged between a husband and wife. This is what a woman's role is as a wife. It is not a small role. It is a very important role. It is a very big role. This is related to marital life.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
With regard to motherhood, the role of a woman is a role where she gives life. A woman produces beings which come from her. This is how it is. She is the one who carries. She is the one who gives birth. She is the one who feeds. She is the one who looks after the child. The lives of human beings are in the hands of mothers. Children owe their lives to their mothers. The love that the Almighty God has placed in the mother's heart for child is unparalleled. There is no other life like it or that is equal to it in quality. She provides life. Generations continue. Mothers bring about the continuation of generations. It is due to motherhood that the human race continues.
Allah, I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.